Novi College of Law, offering students the resources of a major research university, a world-renowned faculty, and opportunities for active learning both in the classroom and beyond. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Some playful music there to get us off into this section of the program this afternoon. We're going to talk about the art of children this afternoon. How do children experience the world? How do they work at making sense of it? One answer is play, and one way to play is to draw. And as adults, we can glimpse the creative lives of children through their art. We can also learn something about the human artistic impulse. On the program this afternoon, The Art of the Child, our guest is art historian Jonathan Feinberg, curator of the exhibition When We Were Young, now at the Krannert Art Museum. The show continues through December. Jonathan has also edited and contributed to an anthology of essays about the art of children. The book, When We Were Children, also features an amazing collection of drawings by famous artists when they were children, and as the book's description puts it, by extraordinary, ordinary children. And one of the things Jonathan says in When We Were Young is this: for both the child and the adult artist, making art is an affirmation of existence in an often bewildering world. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222. 9455 333-WILL 800-222-WILL. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Nice to see you again. To begin, I'd like you to describe and talk about one of the first drawings we see when we open When We Were Children.
When we were young.
Oh, yes. When we were young, and I did it in my introduction too. I had it both ways. The Art of Children, When We Were Young. Thank you. Excuse me. It is labeled Bullfight and Pigeons, and the artist is Pablo Picasso.
Well, you know, everybody, when they think about gifted children, we tend to think about children who can render beautifully, can make a pigeon look just like a pigeon at the age of nine. And that's in part because one of the most famous child prodigies in the art world is, of course, Picasso, and there are not very many childhood drawings left by Picasso, which is in itself very interesting because the accounts of his childhood are that he was drawing obsessively from an early age, and his father was a painter, and you would think that if everybody knew this was a child who they all said they mm-hmm. knew was gifted, how come they didn't save the drawings? Mm-hmm. And of course, the answer to that, I think, is that Picasso himself probably went back and edited them. And what he did is he saved the ones that had this wonderful verisimilitude in the pigeons. Now, if you look at this, we're very privileged, really, at the university to have been able to borrow these. And we have this wonderful childhood drawing of Picasso's. And on the top row is a set of pigeons, which do look like a professional academic artist drew them. And in fact, Picasso's biographer, Richardson, said he thought his father actually drew them. But I know that's not the case for a variety of other reasons. And then underneath, flipped the other way, is something that looks a little bit more like a nine-year-old's drawing. What's fascinating about this and what's so telling, I think, is that you can train a gifted child to draw like an academic artist. And that kind of skill, it's clearly here. But if you look at the childhood drawings of an artist like Sir Edwin Landseer, as I said in the book, he's even better at than Picasso. At the age of five, he could draw a dog, which I've reproduced here, which is magnificent. So if that's the criteria, Landseer should have been a better artist than Picasso. But the truth is that Landseer mm-hmm. spent his entire career drawing these absolutely saccharine, boring pictures of dogs that look like Hallmark greeting cards, and Picasso revolutionized the art world. What's really interesting about this drawing, I would say, is that the scribble in the background, you have a drawing, the bottom half, as I said, the top row, as I said, are these pigeons, which are upside down. And then below that is a bull ring, and the bull and the figures in the bull ring are drawn a little bit more like a child. They're flatter. They're not perfectly rendered. And behind them is a cheering crowd, and the cheering crowd is represented by this scribble, this absolutely wonderful, energetic scribble.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch the line of that scribble, what you see is the line moves from being just gesture, and then suddenly it becomes the contour of a figure. And then it moves out back to gesture again. And that ability, first of all, the self-confidence for a 9-year-old to be able to handle line like that and to express himself is remarkable. That's where you see the real giftedness here. And that ability to see the line as a gesture and then to see it as a contour and then a gesture again, that kind of ability to mutate its roles is what underlies the great genius of Picasso. Picasso's great contribution to modern art was cubism, and what cubism is all about is the ability to see things in multiple ways at the same time. To see it, to take a scrap out of a news, torn out of a newspaper, and you still see it as a newspaper, and at the same time it becomes the contour of a figure. And that's just what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. A fresh look.
A fresh look. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Something else that strikes me about this is that while there's this sort of exuberance that is shown in a scribble, you can also see details like the numbers of the sections of the seats, you know, and that is also interesting to me. The in the art of children here, that's throughout the book, there is often a great deal of detail, and it's so interesting to look at what they pick up on.
Well, actually, that's a really interesting observation I had not focused on myself, Celeste. And I think that what's interesting about it in part is that as adults, we have a set of hierarchies about what's important to represent here. And obviously, this child had a different set of hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we might say, well, why is he putting so much attention onto the numbers? It reminds me of I remember when one of my nephews was a young boy was being toilet trained, and his father said to him, you know, if you go to the toilet, you won't have to wear diapers anymore. And the kid said, can I take my socks off too? and you know, and what you realize when you hear the things that kids say that are so cute often, it's because they're trying to take all the things that they've observed and make sense out of
them. Right.
And so what they've observed sometimes doesn't go together in the way that we think it goes together. And that's part of what makes it so fresh. Sometimes they have insights that we don't have that are right. Sometimes they're very wrong. But it does reveal their thought process and how they go about the process of putting their world back together in some kind of coherent way. So when it's so fascinating to see what it is that a child finds interesting to draw here. Why did he draw the numbers?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the answer to that, but it is a different coherence probably than you or I would have drawn if drawing that scene.
Yeah, there's a drawing later in the book done by your daughter, and she's at rest.
Yes.
And among the details in her drawing is a spider web. And what I guess I would say there's a doll or there's something mm-hmm. behind the pillow.
Right.
So we have her in her world.
Well, one of the interesting things about that drawing, one of the things I love about it is that she has expressed herself relaxing and taking her nap so vividly that it just, you look at it and you feel it in your own body,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's going on there. It's so, she communicates it so well. That's just a wonderful trait. Another thing that's interesting about that is if you look carefully at that drawing, you'll see that right where you saw that little spider in the corner there
mm-hmm.
by the corner of the bed, actually something got spilled on that piece of paper. If you look carefully,
yeah.
there's a spill. And so she figured out how to deal with the spill by making a spider web. And, you know, she adapted to the circumstances that were presenting themselves as she worked. And that's a very interesting part of children's drawings. It's an interesting part of how artists, the adult artists, deal with the world as they experience it. You know, that's part of what we do in play for children, you know, to try and figure out what you're experiencing in the world and
kind process of, it.
Process it and make coherence out of it.
Make sense out of it, yeah. There's a photograph of Picasso with his daughter, Paloma, in the book, and she's a young girl. They're sitting at the kitchen table. She's drawing, I think it's a sailboat.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe this daughter-father scene?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, I got interested in this whole project because about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, I did an exhibition called The Innocent Eye, and that was about the influence of children's drawings on modern artists. You know, we've all heard the joke, my kid can paint a Picasso or a Hans Hofmann. And it's such a common thing for people to say. We've all heard it in art museums, you know. I thought I really ought to find out whether there's any truth to this. And I began to investigate that. And what I discovered was that most of the major 20th century artists were in fact, interested in children's drawings. Many of them had big collections. And when you look at the collections that they had, each collection looks completely unlike the others, and it's always very closely related to whatever was most important to that artist in their career. In the case of Cubism, I said, you know, that's Picasso's great innovation, and it's all about how you see and how you transform what you see and that you maintain multiple levels of seeing at the same time. Picasso, I did find some of the drawings by his children leafed into the books in his library in Paris, actually, and among them drawings by Paloma and Claude. But what interested Picasso was watching the kids at work. It was that the freedom of invention that was happening as they allowed their fantasy to develop. And you can see, of course, why that would interest him. It fit his own protocol so interestingly. I love that photograph because he's devouring her. I mean, the intensity of the look on his face is just unbelievable. And I actually talked to Paloma about this. We spent an afternoon just talking about her experiences in, you know, sitting in her father's studio when he worked. And Picasso really did allow his children free rein. You know, the house was filled with art. Things were being created all over the place. And with the children, they were bouncing balls and playing with things amongst priceless works of art and never bothered him at all. And she said she used to sit in the studio when he was working and she would draw. And she has very fond memories of this and also of him watching her and being really interested in what she did creatively. So I think he absorbed a lot, and we know from some of the accounts of Brassai and others that he really watched closely and was fascinated by the freedom with which children created.
Yeah. Have artists written or talked about what they glean from the art of children?
Yes, and there are many different kinds of examples. But, you know, one of the places that they talk the most is in their own work. And in the exhibition at the Cranor, I also have a print that Picasso made as an illustration for Balzac. It was done in 1927. I'm actually looking at it in the book right here called The Painter and Knitting Model. But it was part of a set of illustrations that it did. And it shows the artist sitting in a room drawing on a canvas or painting on a canvas. Looks like he's actually drawing and drawing a model and the model sitting there. And on the canvas, you have a scribble, what looks like a scribble, complete free-form line. And the drawing, the rest of the drawing of the two figures, is done in this very meticulous neoclassical style. It was Picasso at his most rigorously classical moment, obviously influenced by the drawings of Ang. And when you look carefully at this, you realize, first of all, that the drawing that's inside the canvas is not random at all. Although it looks like scribbles, it's not at all scribbles. It's very balanced. It's perfectly in control. And when you look at the outside the picture, that is outside the world of art in a way, what's really wild and out of control are the little places like the artist's beard, the hair on the woman's head. Right in the middle of the neoclassical drawing, that's where you have the wildness. And Picasso is very deliberately making a kind of, like a set of tongue twisters, he's making a kind of commentary on on drawing and freedom and what how line expresses things and control and loss of control, all of these things that are relevant, already seen in a way or prefigured in that childhood drawing. He's very consciously working through all that right here.
Mm. But did he put it into words somewhere?
Picasso didn't very much. Some artists did much more. Kandinsky really tried to do that. Clay tried to do that. They did really talk much more. It's kind of more of a German tradition, I suppose, anyway, or maybe it's a personality trait. Some of them did talk a great deal more about it. But, you know, artists discover things and make things, work out ideas on the canvas. That's why they're artists. And so bringing it into the realm of words is, in a way, the problem of the critic.
Yeah, or a writer.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of clay, there's two paintings that are in the book when we're young, but I'm thinking of now. It is Paul and Felix, and they are remarkably similar.
Yeah, the story of clay is a very interesting one. You know, I said that when I discovered the collections that major artists amassed of children's drawings, that they all look different. In the case of clay, his project really was about authenticity. He was interested in the structure of his own mind. He was interested in what was original to him. And when you look at clay's work, I can't think of any other really major 20th century master for whom this is as true, that you look at a big exhibition as like the one we just had at the Phillips Collection that was adjacent to this exhibition when it was in Washington. And it looks like, at first, like it's done by several different artists. And it's because with each work of Clay's, you feel like he's looking at a particular problem, and that everything about the definition of that work revolves around the resolution of that problem, so that the style can take these kinds of jumps. Although, if you know Clay's work, you begin to know his mind and his hand. It's like a conceptual artist. It's not the style per se, but it's a style of thought that's the real consistency there. But the particular example you're talking about is a little painting that his son Felix did in 1919. And the funny thing about that, you know, when I was working on that first exhibition, I would go to see Alyosha Clay, his grandson, periodically, who was the heir to the estate, is the heir to the estate. And he knew what I was working on. And one day he pulled out of a closet this painting by Clay from 1920. And he said, "I thought you'd be interested in this." And then he pulled out the drawing by Felix. And he said, "I thought you'd like to see this, too." And basically Clay took the top half of that drawing, just cut it in half, and made a painting himself out of the top half of the painting. Well, it's a little shocking when you first see it because it's so close to the other work. Now, there are many things about it that are fundamentally changed. By cutting out the bottom half of it, he's eliminated the child's attempt to create a normal space, and instead, because of his own thoughts about cubism and other very sophisticated issues that the child is probably not at all aware of, he's turned this into a discourse with contemporary painting, while at the same time making a work that is about that problem of authenticity. What way does his child inherit his talent? How unique is his work in relation to the child's work? How is it changed by having him do what the child did? It's all those problems. That's a problem which, for example, Rauschenberg comes back to in the late 1950s when he does Factum 1 and 2. He tries to do two identical paintings with an expressionist brushstroke to see if he can make them exactly the same. And, of course, they don't come out exactly the same. So it's a problem that's intrigued a lot of artists, and I think that's one of the issues that's being addressed here.
Very interesting. Our guest this afternoon here on the program, art historian Jonathan Feinberg, curator of the exhibition When We Were Young, now at the Krannert Art Museum. The show continues through December. Jonathan Feinberg is a professor of art history and visiting professor in computer science and university scholar at the University of Illinois. He is also director of the university's program at the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon afternoon with questions or comments about the art of the child, the art of children. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, now we've both mentioned the Phillips Collection. What is it?
Well, this is a very unique thing that's happened. It was kind of by chance that I was on the Board of Trustees of the Phillips Collection, which is the oldest museum of modern art in the country. It predates MoMA in New York by about 5 years. And it's a very small museum in a mansion in Washington right in DuPont Circle, and it's very famous because almost everything, though it's a small collection, almost everything is a masterpiece. It goes from Renoir's Boating Party through Rothko and to the present. And they were building a new building when I first joined the board about a year and a half ago, and I realized that they were getting themselves an auditorium and a whole floor of a library that they'd never had before, and a number of things that would enable them to do really fulfill the vision of the founder. One of his major concerns was to try and explain to people the way in which works of art are really relevant to the way they live their lives, that a museum is not a separate experience, but it is continuous with your life, and it's a place where you can resolve things that are relevant to you. And the hallmark of the museum is that it's like sitting in a living room that's your house, and there's a great painting in front of you. And so there's this intimacy, the kind of closeness, or up close and personal, so to speak, with great works of art that's the hallmark there. So I said, you know, if you're the part of this vision that's not being fulfilled here is to have a study center. We really need to have a study center. We have public programs. And the long and short of it is they gave me the garage, which they didn't know what to do with. It was falling down. And we renovated the garage, made a beautiful little building, which is now has the University of Illinois' name on it, because we happen to have a really visionary set of people running this university now. This president and chancellor and provost are really remarkable people who understand what the future for education really is about. And when I went to Richard Herman and said, you know, we have this opportunity here, he right away said, we're going to just do this. And we set up a program there, a kind of satellite of the University of Illinois. We have University of Illinois students going there. We have 6 courses being staffed and taught by university faculty. We have these students are actually working in the museum. So some of these some of our University of Illinois interns are now working in just the state-of-the-art, amazing place with some of the most famous curators in the world. And they're really seeing, they're having an experience that is just unique. It's really fabulous. And so we've got this little house there for the University of Illinois, which was built really by the Phillips. And it's a great collaboration. So
that's terrific. So if you're in Washington, D.C., check out the Phillips.
And this exhibition is really the first manifestation of that collaboration because it was in both places.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the art of extraordinary, ordinary children that are in the show and in the book When We Were Young. One of the drawings that I am quite fond of is called The Lion's Toothpaste.
That's a great drawing. It's just amazing what kids do. That's done by a 3-year-old. It's unbelievable that it's done by a 3-year-old, but it's done by a 3-year-old Japanese girl. These drawings in the book come from all over the world. And you do see, it has been striking to me how wonderful the design sense is for a lot of these Japanese kids. I don't know why it's different, but they seem to really finish the works. But this is a really great, funny but also a beautiful drawing. I'm not sure what else to say about it except to say that, you know, you look at a child solving a problem and there are elements of it that, as I say, they kind of put them together in a way that you would never think to put them together, and yet they have a kind of resonance for us. This is the kind of drawing, by the way, our radio audience can't see this right now, but if you look in the book, you would see it. It's a head of a lion, and the lion's face fills almost the whole page, and the rest of the body and the hair, the lion's mane, go right out to the edges. And there's this little guy in the corner with a giant toothbrush brushing the lion's teeth. And it's kind of funny, but, you know, there's another aspect of this compositionally where this thing, it fills the page so completely that it seems huge, even though it's a tiny little drawing. And, you know, that's exactly what Rothko loved about children's drawings, and he actually wrote about it in his journals. He said, you know, the children have the capacity to heroify the subject, is the word he used. Mm. And when you think about Rothko's paintings, the great Rothko paintings, what he did with this, he took a simple square and he filled the picture so completely with the square that it felt confined in the way this child's drawing does, and it becomes enormous as a result of that. And he actually taught children's art classes in the Jewish Center in Brooklyn for many years.
Yeah, well, you get a sense of the enormity of this animal,
right?
And although the lion is having his or her teeth brushed, I have a sense that we might be, if this drawing could come to life, we would be blown up against the wall for the sound that's coming from the lion's mouth, because it is so wide open.
Yeah.
And the other thing that the human being in this drawing is seems so kind.
And also small, and it's also
small.
Look at the color choice that she made. You know, it's like a kind of each part of the person has a different color, mm-hmm. like a little rainbow.
Yeah. And the toothpaste, you got to have a lot of toothpaste for a lion. And the toothpaste tube is quite large when it is next to
the
caretaker.
Hydrant.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very interesting. There are differences, it seems to me, from place to place, culture to culture. Another one of the drawings that I was struck by is called Full of Blossoms, and this is another Japanese girl, age 5. And I don't know if you've seen or you recall the Kurosawa dream film, Dreams. The first dream in the movie is blossoms.
That's interesting.
Orange blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
It's magnificent. I'll never forget that image from the film. And I turned to this and I, you know, there is something about person, you know, in our humanity, the kinds of things that we're drawn to recreate.
Well, you started talking about culture with this, and I think that's a relevant thing to say here, that the fact that you would pick a Kurosawa film, there are paradigms in any culture, and we do pick them up at an early age. You know, we often think of children as being innocent, which is utter nonsense. Children are anything but innocent. And from the very first day that you hand a child a square piece of paper, you're giving them instructions about the space. So there's always, you know, there are always instructions, and the task of childhood is, of course, to learn the codes of the adult mm-hmm. world they grow up in. So there are cultural issues that come up in children's drawings right from the very beginning. And certainly there are continuities, just as, you know, we know that, you know, the way life exists in Japan or in France or someplace else are culturally determined. They have a flavor to us that we recognize, and those commonalities may be there for all of the uniqueness and difference in individuals. So certainly those things are there.
Yeah. I was talking with someone just yesterday. Actually, she's got three sons, and they are 4, 2, and 4 months. And the middle boy just learned what crayons are for. And his older brother can write his name. And so Donna told me that she came into a room and they had been at work on the wall with the crayons. And she said, "Now, who's done this?" And Joshua says very proudly, "I wrote my name and Tyler colored that." And they were so pleased. You know, this gets back to the idea of the paper as an instruction. You know, we've got to learn the rules, but that they were so proud at what they, you know, what they had done. So she said, you know, well, what we need to do is move to the kitchen table and, you know, take care of the wall.
There's always a negotiation going on, but it's pretty wonderful that they did that.
Yeah, they were so pleased, you know. There was such joy in it, you know.
And also, sometimes we have to be loose enough to say to ourselves, you know, that's really great. Maybe we should leave it there.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that is a good idea. We have, after all, people like Sol LeWitt, who's made a career of wall drawings that the contemporary artist who came onto the New York scene in the late 1960s and innovated that as a medium. And he actually makes paintings right on the wall. And now, of course, he's a very celebrated artist for having done that.
Yeah. Some years back, my husband and I knew a young family. They had two little girls, and the parents had done something I thought was just wonderful. They had taken the children's artwork, and they had taken other artwork that the children liked, and they had put it at the eye level of the child. So when you walked into their room, there was a lot of artwork at knee level, you know, my knee level, but it was wonderful. And then as they grew up, the artwork moved up the wall.
You know, it was fascinating. It's fascinating to watch the viewers in an exhibition often. But, you know, when I did the Innocent Eye exhibition in Munich and in Bern, it had a lot of the childhood drawings that artists had collected up with major masterpieces. And I saw a lot of families come into this exhibition. It was a very sophisticated exhibition. It's not really, it's not aimed at children. It's quite a complicated idea, really. But the children came in and they immediately recognized children's drawings on the wall, and it was empowering. And I was very surprised to see what happened, which is that the children started marching through that exhibition, you know, commenting on everything on the wall. It was really great, and it felt like it was their space. And I've seen a lot of kids in this exhibition and in the Cranford Art Museum now, in part because I think they have an opportunity. One of the wonderful things that the Cranford Art Museum did, I thought was a great idea, not my idea, but they created a space at the very front of the museum where kids can draw, and then when they finish, they take the drawings and put them up on the wall just in the front of the exhibition. There's a big wall full of kids' drawings. It's great, and they're constantly changing.
And that's really empowering, too. There
Absolutely.
Are all those tables and chairs. It just looks so like such a happy space.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same. You see the same thing happen when you're in a room and it's primarily adults, and then there's a child in there, and then another child comes into the room. There's like, you know, this is us.
Yeah, this is about empowering creativity in a way, and that's something we're realizing happens in all realms of human activity, and we need to foster that.
Yeah. Now, with your own kids, how did you do that?
Oh, I have no idea what the answer to that question is. They just did it. I think they did it.
Yeah.
And they, you know, we've always, of course, given them the materials and encouraged them to do things, and they all did things that were really quite different. My son, who's always been interested in, you know, electricity and mechanics and, you know, how to build things, was already early on building amazing things. And there's a drawing in the book here, which he made when he was 8 years old. We were in Paris, and I wouldn't have known what it was except that he explained this all to my wife, and she recorded it all. But he's made a pocket knife, which is actually an electric solar-powered pocket knife, and it's got a headset and toothpicks and a recorder and a little dishwasher and all kinds of things, a bug box, you know, and all these different things connected to it. And, the character is so much there already, that kind of inventiveness. And you just, you know, it's a celebration of something wonderful. You know, and kids really teach us to see in different ways if you're open to it.
Yeah, there's a story that you tell about your son Henry and your wife Marianne. It involves a fire truck.
Oh, the fire truck! That was
amazing. Tell us the story.
That was an amazing moment. Marianne is very, very open to these kinds of things. She saw right what was going on. I'm not sure I would have seen it so fast, but she walked into the room. He was very young, and he stood up on his bed. I think he just very recently gotten out of a crib. And there was a fire truck outside, and he stood up in his bed and he said, "It's in my room." And, of course, her first impulse is to say, "No, it's not in the room. It's out in the street and coming from the fire truck." And then she realized, yes, it was in his room. It was actually the sound he was responding to, which was in his room. And it was a kind of a moment of being able to see something in a fresh way as an adult, mm-hmm. because the child had picked up exactly what it was and didn't have the preconceptions of how to organize it into little boxes yet.
Yeah. One of the, on the back of the book, When We Were Young, there's a blurb from Ellen Handler Spitz.
Mm-hmm.
And I had her on the program some time back. And I remember her telling me, you know, we are so often saying to children, look, look, look. And she says, you know, often sometimes what we need to do really is to step back and let them tell us or say to us, look.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And she told a story about a mother and a daughter going into an apartment that was in a, you know, really like skyscraper, and this little girl comes into the room, and there are these lovely, gorgeous, huge picture windows, and she says, she just explodes with, it is, I think she said, royal blue. And what she was talking about was the sky, mm-hmm. you know. And again, you know, it's a new way. It's a fresh take. It's another way to contemplate our world, or to see it, to actually see it.
Well, you know, it's also partly the reason I got interested in children's drawings is because I'm interested in adult drawings, and it tells us something about the process and how it works in relation to people. You know, you realize that what artists are doing is they are constantly seeing things in a way that we don't normally see them, and that they're meaningful because they found a way to give form to something that we feel but don't yet know how to articulate. And it's very important that a society has that ability, you know, the ability to talk about things that we don't yet have words for. And if we don't have that, things get repressed and not resolved.
Mm. And you also quote in the book the French poet, 19th century great French poet.
Baudelaire.
Yeah. Genius is the ability to regain, willfully regain.
Childhood regained at will.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what he says. Yes, I think it was his perception, too, that that there was some essential quality of kind of openness in childhood, which we needed to, as adults, if the great artists had the ability to recapture that quality, and that had great use. You know, the Romantics thought that that children were in fact closer somehow to God than adults, and that you would really find out what the world, what the underlying structure of the world was by studying children. There's a famous story of Shelley, the poet Shelley, going through the backs at Cambridge, and he sees a woman, and from as best I can determine, this is actually a true story, that he sees a woman with a pram walking through the garden, and he reaches in and takes the baby and holds the baby up and looks it in the face and says, "Tell me about pre-existence." But there was that sense that somehow, you know, that real inspiration, real meaning, you know, was on a level that you could access if you were able to work your way ontogenetically backwards to those kinds of sources.
Yeah. How did you decide what to include?
Well, there were a couple of criteria, and there are some questions I had in mind to begin with. I wanted to know what old children's drawings look like, so that was an important part of this. We mostly just see contemporary children, and we make assumptions about how children draw, but we really didn't have much documentation for that. So in the back of the book, you'll see a chronology where I really went all the way back, as far as I could anyway, to see how much I could document in the way of what has been written about children's drawings, where it's been exhibited, how it's been discussed. And one of the oldest examples I could find in literature is in Boccaccio's Decameron, where there's a description by one of the storytellers about a family saying that their faces are really misshapen. And then they say, well, it really looks like children's drawings. And they proceed to describe what a child's drawing looks like. Well, that told me a lot about what children's drawings, you know, were looking mm-hmm. like in the late Middle Ages and how much in common they did have with today's children's drawings. But the earliest ones that I could find, there's documentation of this boy Anfim, been excavated by these bark paintings around Novgorod from the Middle Ages. But the first place that I could find a real body of children's drawings to really have a good look were the childhood drawings of Louis XIII, who was born in 1601. And, of course, who but a king's mother could save his drawings, so to speak? You know, paper was expensive before the 19th century because it wasn't made out of wood pulp, and it was, you know, there's very little that survived. A few cases where we have these artists one or two works that remain of them. There's a few drawings from a Latin primer in The Hague that I found from the early 16th century. But these drawings of Louis are fascinating. Louis's physician, who looked over his growth from the day he was born in 1601 until the physician died and Louis was, you know, really a young man. he recorded everything about the growth of the young king. That was his job, and it's like a modern scientific journal, four handwritten volumes in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And interleaved into it are Louis's drawings, and Louis was clearly a gifted child. And what was so fascinating is Louis's obsession with drawing. And this journal tells you the exact day everything was made, who helped him, what he said about it. It's very interesting, and you really have a document of what a child's growth in drawing looked like in the 17th century. And so it was a great point of comparison. So that was one of the things I wanted to do, was to put some old children's drawings in here. I also wanted to see to what extent I could find the childhood drawings of people that we knew would become great artists, and also the childhood drawings of a few people who we knew would be great figures who were not artists. I thought that was interesting, the childhood drawings of Dwight Eisenhower, or, you know, mm-hmm. what did Ted Turner's drawings look like as a kid, that kind
of
thing.
There's one in here.
Yeah, there is one in there. And so there was that. And then there was my interest in trying to put that in without any sense of hierarchy, just have a kind of flow organized by age of those drawings along with contemporary children from all over the world. And I picked them in a very unscientific way. I just thought things that looked interesting for a variety of reasons, because what I was interested in here was the invention, the innovativeness, the aesthetic qualities of a child's drawing to me, rather than trying to find the norms, because that's what the pedagogues and the psychologists have always been interested in, is what way are all the children the same? Mm. And the artists are really the only ones that ever really came at this from an art point of view and said, what's different about them?
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for uniqueness and visual interest. And so I thought I'd just get a big collection and put them all together and let's see what it looks like. And that was really my very unscientific approach to this problem.
Yeah, well, they're wonderful. There's one there that is next to the king's drawing that is so different. Maybe you'd describe that. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're looking at one here actually in the middle of this kind of gallery. I've organized this book so that the first third is really essays about some of these particular issues. An essay by Arnheim, an essay about Louis's drawings. And then the middle section is a kind of a gallery of these children's drawings just arranged by age. And the one you're looking at, actually this isn't Louis's drawing, but it's a drawing by Pierre Alashinsky, who's a very well-known Cobra artist, still alive, but very well-known, especially in the 1950s. And here he is in 1935 drawing, says, our visit to the zoo, and it has a camel and an elephant on it. And there were only two of those that he had left from his childhood, but they do have a lot to do with his mature work. And then facing that is a drawing by an 8-year-old girl from the Czech Republic. It's just a very colorful drawing mm-hmm. of somebody out taking her dog for a stroll here, and the dog sitting up looking intently at her, and there's all this energy around the hair with the drawing of the hair and. I mean, the patterns and colors are just wonderful.
There is also an essay in the book about it begins with a little discussion about Barney.
Mm-hmm. The influence of popular
culture on children's art, and that pops up in some of the pieces that are in there. I think there's some. I don't know if they're Ninja Turtles or they're.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was actually drawn by then a little boy in my daughter's primary school here, University Primary. He's now a young man, but it's a Ninja Turtle. That essay was written by Tina Thompson, who used to be on the faculty here. A wonderful essay about the influence of popular culture. The underlying point there is that, of course, children are looking around them all the time, and they see all sorts of things. Things don't come just from inside. They also come from outside, and the meeting point between mm-hmm. the two. And so they're looking at advertising and television. Somebody asked me this morning, I thought it was an interesting question, when you look at early children's drawings, that is before television, you often see children drawing. Her question to me was, what had changed? Could you really see an evolution in children's drawing? And you know, this was an interesting point, because there's this drawing in the show which is illustrated in a book of 1939 by Victor Lowenfeld. This was a drawing that was in his collection. And you see the two eyes of the figures are on the same side of the head. So it's a profile drawing with the nose in profile because it's easier to draw that way, and the two eyes on one side of the head. After television and kids watching cartoons frequently, that almost completely disappears from children's drawings. So you have an instance, really, of childhood being interpreted by adults back to children and then children assimilating that. So they're already assimilating protocols of how you represent the human head there. Fascinating.
Yeah.
But certainly advertising is there and all kinds of other things from the world.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we're out of time.
Well, thanks for having me. I really
enjoyed
doing
it. I hope you'll come back.
I sure will.
Jonathan Feinberg has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. When We Were Young, now at the Krannert Art Museum. Also look for the book, the essays, and the gallery in the back, When We Were Young, New Perspectives on the Art of the Child. Jonathan, thank you again.
Thanks.
It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in now for the grains from Kansas City and from Chicago. Here's Jay Pierce.
Well, thank you much, Celeste. Indeed, they are. December wheat in Kansas City at a high price of 516, the low of 507 today, settled at 515 and a quarter, up 3 3/4. The March contract had a high of 530, a low of 522, settled at 529 and a half, up 3 3/4 as well. And the May contract had a high of 526, a low of 516, settled at 526, up 7 1/4. December wheat in Chicago had a high of 475, a low of 466, settled at 474, up 5 1/4. The March contract had a high of 495, a low of 485, settled at 494, up 5. May had a high of 494, a low of 485, settled at 493.5, up 6 1/4. July, a high of 471, a low of 462, settled at 470, up 5 1/4. And September, high of 470, a low of 467, settled at 467, up 3. December corn had a high of 356, a low of 346, settled at 355 1/4, up 3 3/4. March had a high of 372, a low of 361, settled at 370 1/2, up 4 1/2. May had a high of 374, a low of 366, settled at 373 1/2, up 2 1/4. The July contract had a high of 378, a low of 365 1/2, a settlement at 376, and that was up 3. September 07 had a high today of 357, a low of 351, settled at 355, down 1 3/4. And December 07 had a high of 344 1/2, a low of 337 1/2, the settlement 339 3/4, down 2. January soybeans, the high today was 661, the low 652 1/2, settled at 660 1/2, up 4. March also up 4. The high today was 637 1/2, the low 665. Settlement 672 3/4. Again, that was up 4. May had a high of 683, a low of 673. Settlement 682, up 4 1/4. The July soybeans had a high of 690 1/2, a low of 682, settlement 690 1/4, up